B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the guy using your member number at the snack bar, Charlie Nance.
Hey, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy, and it's an odd week in the world of golf, as there's really not much going on. The PGA Tour's wraparound season for 2019-2020 gets started next week in West Virginia at the Greenbrier. More on that in a second. Anyway, we're going to take this week to recover from Labor Day weekend and look back at some of our more interesting conversations. We'll start with one of my favorite writers on the beat. Karen Krause works for the New York Times and is perhaps one of the most intuitive and introspective sports writers I've ever come across. A couple of years ago, we spoke on the occasion of Patrick Cantlay's breakthrough first win about a piece she wrote on him, and it's as interesting today as it was then. One of my favorite chats this year came with Oliver Ollie Horovitz, host of Caddy Codes on ShopWithGolf.com. Earlier this summer, prior to the Open Championship, we discussed an episode of his show, and it featured a round at Royal Portrush, site of the Open Championship. And we'll wrap things up today as we get ready for the Greenbrier with Blake Taylor. Blake's a tremendous player for Andrew Sapp's ECU Pirates, and last year he actually qualified for and competed in this tournament with the pros. So let's get things started with the brilliant Karen Krause from almost 2 years ago discussing Patrick Cantlay. Karen, before we get to Patrick Cantlay, I'm just curious. In addition to writing about golf, you've written a lot about swimming and tennis. Not to say that you don't write about team sports, but it seems that you have sort of a concentration on individual sports. Is this just the way it's worked out with your assignments with the Times, or is this a conscious effort on your part?
It's the way it's worked out. I actually was hired by the Times to cover the Jets, and I did so for 3 years. So it's not as if I have an aversion to team sports, but even when I was covering the team sports, I was always looking for the individual story. So I think covering these individual sports is right up my alley, because I am so fascinated by human nature and the resilience of the human spirit and how people overcome tremendous odds and how otherwise ordinary flawed people can achieve remarkable things. So that, I just find it endlessly fascinating. And so golf and tennis provides a real window into that kind of storytelling.
Is there one universal commonality between people who make it to the elite level in individual sports, whether you be a Michael Phelps or a Katie Ledecky, or you're a tennis player or you're a professional golfer? Is there one thing that you can put your finger on that all of them have?
Most of them have the perfectionist gene, and while that serves them beautifully in their sports, it sometimes makes it hard for them to transition to a so-called normal life afterward, because, as you know and I know only too well, none of us is perfect. We're all flawed. And so I think when they do realize that they are in most ways just like everybody else, that is hard for some of them to accept and process, because they have been told their whole lives that how important it is for them to be better than. So when you've been told your whole life that you need to be better than, to accept that you have the same flaws as everybody, it's what makes us human, it can be very difficult for them to process.
Karen Krause, brilliant writer with the New York Times, is our guest taking dead aim. You know, in every sport, you have the stories of the can't-miss kids who do, the David Clydes of the world, Marcus Duprees, LeBradford Smith. They litter the landscape in sports history, and I thought that Patrick Cantlay was going to end up as one of these. I want you to just explain how big a deal this guy was as an amateur and a college player.
So we're talking endlessly this season in the golf world about this amazing class that includes Justin Thomas, Jordan Spieth, these kids that were in college in 2012, and you know how fantastic they have done on the PGA Tour in their early 20s. this is the perspective you need to know how good Patrick was. He was the number one ranked amateur during that time for a record 55 weeks. So he was considered more of a can't miss product than Jordan Spieth, a better golfer and prospect than Justin Thomas, both of whom have won majors. So that's the perspective. So he came out in 2012 after his sophomore year, a few months before Jordan did. They both started playing some web.com events in early 13 because they had limited entry into PGA Tour events. At an event in March, Patrick won, beat a field that included Jordan, who finished seven strokes back. So I'm just giving you the perspective here. We look at Jordan as otherworldly. Patrick made Jordan look human back in college and then in 2013. What happened to Patrick, why many people might not have ever heard of him, is in May of 2013, he tweaked his back while warming up for an event in Texas and didn't really think anything of it, but it just kept getting progressively worse and worse. He only made one, between then and February of this year, he only made six starts and was told in January of last year, January of 2016, Patrick, your back is not progressing. You need to shut it down completely. You can't even putt for the next 10 months, nothing. So that's the reality that he was facing, going from number one ranked amateur in the world to a really promising start to his pro career to being sidelined completely.
Yeah, and, you know, out of sight, out of mind. And then I remember watching the Valspar Championship in March, and there he was. It was like Roy Hobbs appearing out of the mist, and then he damn near beat Adam Hadwin. It was incredible, and that's when I started paying attention.
So that was the tournament that you watched was his second start, and he finished second. He finished fourth in his fourth start. So here is a player who has basically been off for 3 years, and he's able to finish in the top five in two of his first three starts back. That would be a remarkable story unto itself. However, there's an even bigger piece to this that makes you want to root for him all the more. So if you go back and look at pictures of Patrick when he played, I believe it was the 2012 Masters, he had his best friend caddying for him. So if you find pictures of Patrick with his caddy wearing the number 61 overall, that was his best friend, Chris Roth, with whom he had played golf at Servite High, which is an all-boys school in Orange County. Chris was his best friend, and if you know Patrick, he's very serious. And Chris had a leavening effect on him because Chris was the life of the party, had a smile like Tiger Woods that you were just drawn to. So he started caddying for Patrick, and the whole idea was that he would be Patrick's caddy moving forward, that they would experience this PGA Tour adventure together. The Servite golf coach told the Orange County Register in a story this year that he envisioned Chris and Patrick having a Phil and Bones type relationship on the links. So obviously Patrick can't play, and so he's really leaning on his friends all the more. He and Chris are out one night in February of last year, and Chris, while walking across the street, is hit by a car not 10 feet from Patrick, and he is killed. And the driver of the car kept going, so it was a hit and run. So it was left to Patrick to cradle his best friend in his arms while dialing 911, and by the time they got him to the hospital, Chris was pronounced dead. So not in a matter of weeks, Patrick is left to process the fact that his once promising golf career is on hold for at least another 10 months, and he has lost one of the most important people in his life, and he witnessed the accident. Charlie, I'm not sure how you ever get over that. I have tried to put myself in this young man's shoes, and I just can't imagine how you crawl out of the fetal position after being dealt that double blow.
Well, maybe it's another trait of these people who are so great in individual sports, how they get to an elite level. It's that you, from an early age, you learn that the only person you have that you can rely on is yourself, and you're somehow right. able to pick yourself up. Karen Krause is with the New York Times. She's our guest taking Dead Aim. She's written a brilliant piece on Patrick Cantlay. Check my Twitter feed out and hit the link. It is really something special. One of the fascinating things about the story is how Cantlay has maintained an ongoing relationship with Roth's parents and they with him. I mean, we all grieve in different ways. So, you know, right. none of us is qualified to judge. But God, on the surface, this would seem to be a constant harsh reminder for both, right?
Right. So this is how my story that you're referencing came to be. I'm out following Patrick, and I come to realize that Chris's parents are in the gallery. And so I start talking to them, and my question is as basic as that, like, is this bittersweet for you to be out here? And I think the piece of it that makes it so poignant is there but for this horrible accident, they are watching Chris caddy for Patrick. So they said they were coming out to these tournaments. They've been to a couple this year. In fact, they were at the PGA Championship following Patrick. So they've come out, and they're doing this to support him. But as one of Patrick's friends who had also had Chris caddy for him for a while told me, it must help them on some level because Patrick carries pieces of Chris with him. I think they were such a close pair that it's hard to think of Chris without thinking of Patrick and vice versa. So this friend of both, of Patrick and Chris, surmise that perhaps it's cathartic for Chris's parents to see Patrick because it is, in a way, feeling a piece of him, of their son as well. But the mother, I almost started crying when she told me this because I asked her, do you think you might be getting more out of this or Patrick? And she said, well, you know, we hope that Patrick is getting something positive out of our support, but I often worry that we're hindering him because when he does see us, it is a reminder of what he lost. And so I asked Patrick, you know, is it hard at all for you to see Gary and Michelle in your gallery? And he said, no, not at all. In fact, it's the opposite. They remind me of someone with whom, you know, I have such fond memories. So it was just a very poignant story. And there was this moment I actually thought I seemed to be the least composed person of everyone that I was talking to while reporting this story. But at the seventh hole at Conway Farms is kind of tucked out of the way, and so the green is surrounded by trees, and it's pretty far from where all the action is, where all the corporate boxes are and such. So Patrick was playing with Lucas Glover on Sunday, and even though they were both, you know, in the mix at the start of the day, the gallery was maybe a dozen. So Patrick hit a shot really close, within 4 feet on his approach. And Gary, Chris's father, yelled, "That a kid!" That's his phrase for "that a kid" to Patrick. And so the marshal that was manning the green obviously heard this because there was literally no one else around. And he said, "Oh, are you a member of Patrick's family?" And I could see in the seconds it took Gary to answer this question that his brain was working like, what a loaded question this is, and how do I answer it? And so he just said, yeah, because, you know, they are, in a way, part of this family. They are taught, they have a bond that is as tight as the families. They're bonded by this terrible tragedy. And it's just, you realize that in that moment, I realized this isn't easy. Even something as simple as a question of, are you with Patrick? And, you know, what is your relationship to Patrick, can really stir up all of these feelings. But Chris's parents were wonderful. I had caught up with them on Saturday at the end of Patrick's third round, and they just peeled away at the 18th hole. They said, we don't want to bother Patrick. He knows we're here, but we just want to support him. We don't want him to feel like he has to entertain us. And I know that Patrick does appreciate it. He had a 62-foot putt for eagle on 18. The eagle, if he had made it, would have definitely put him in the top 30 and advanced him to the tour championship. Well, he left the eagle putt 11 feet short, and it was a tricky putt left with a couple breaks in it. He knew, and everyone watching knew, he had to make that putt to have any chance to finish in the top 30 in the FedEx Cup standings. He makes the putt as clutch can be, and then he's walking to the scoring area, and again, Gary and Michelle, Chris's parents, are following behind, but several feet away, several yards away, actually, and Patrick sees his longtime swing coach, Jamie Mulligan, and he goes, hey, Jamie, Gary and Michelle are over there. So Jamie goes over and fist bumps Gary, and it's just hard not to observe all of this, which on the surface is just another Sunday on the PGA Tour, people supporting people they know, and just feel and not feel incredibly moved by what you're witnessing.
Kids, let me read you a great sentence. Though headed their separate ways, they will always be united by their greatest loss. That's the final sentence in the piece from Karen Krause, New York Times writer. She's our guest, Taking Dead Aim. What's the relationship like between Cantlay and his current caddy? I think that in some ways it would be kind of a weird situation, not unlike the woman who's the first date of a widower.
Exactly. That's such a good analogy. And it was funny because Chris's parents said, please don't misunderstand. Matt Minister is Patrick's caddy, and he's worked with Nick Price and I believe Chip Beck, and he's had a long and illustrious career out there. But he is, I don't think I saw him smile once. So imagine if you're Chris's parents and you're watching this give and take between Matt and Patrick, and in your mind you're remembering how Chris had a smile on his face. It was omnipresent. So I think that part of the piece of it was hard for them. They said, we love Matt, but, you know, it's hard for us to look at him and not see how Chris would have been just so ebullient in everything he did out there. But Matt is very businesslike, and I was asking Jamie, Patrick's swing coach, why do you think that's such a good pair? Why Matt is so good for Patrick? And he said, well, Patrick is super smart. You can see that just in the way he dissects the course, and his course management is that of a, you know, 45-year-old. And he said that Matt is also very intellectual, and so he can keep Patrick engaged. I'm not sure I could caddy for Patrick. I think my conversation would bore him after 9 holes. But Matt can keep him engaged, and so that's a big part of their success. When you talk about the relationship that this family continues to have with Patrick, Mr. Roth told me that when Patrick is home, and he only made 12 starts this year, that's another incredible piece of the story, is Patrick advanced to the Tour Championship while making 12 starts. Keegan Bradley, to just give you some perspective, made, I believe, 28 starts and just missed. So most players are around 21 to 25 starts.
Oh, yeah. No, here are Patrick's stats for the year. 12 for 12, tournament started, cuts made. Seven top 25s, no finish lower than 48th.
So it's very consistent. But when he is home, which is often practicing, he will occasionally go out to lunch with Chris's dad. And I said, "What do you talk about?" And he said, "Well, there are two subjects that never come up, Chris and golf." And I said, "Well, that's actually kind of lovely that you have so many things that can fill the void that aren't golf or Chris." And he said, "Well, you know, please don't misunderstand. Some of those lunches will pass in companionable silence." And I just thought, you know, what a godsend for both of these people that they're able to have this, that there is some therapy in that, even if neither says a word during these lunches. So I can't really, you know, I have joked, anyone who knows the USC-UCLA rivalry knows how Bruins do not like Trojans and vice versa. I'm a USC grad. Patrick went to UCLA, and I can't root hard enough for him. I just think he personifies resilience and has such an indomitable spirit. It's an inspiration to all of us.
Get you out of here on this real quick. Look, we went over Pat's stats for the year. He had a really, really great year. No question he's comeback player of the year, rookie of the year. I mean, no question. But this back thing is not going away, and obviously he has sort of a handle on what he can and can't do. Does this limit his ceiling somewhat, though?
I don't think so, because I actually think that he, by accident, is going to change the way a lot of these young players look at scheduling their careers moving forward. Let's review who is not at the Tour Championship. The defending champion, Rory McIlroy, who's had a year-long rib injury. These players, because of obligations to sponsors, because of obligations to the tour that does not allow them an off-season at all. Remember, the new season starts the week after next week's President's Cup. These players are playing entirely too much golf, and nobody seems to be stepping in to say enough is enough. So this injury forced Patrick to be really smart about it. He said, obviously, I want to play more than 12 times a year moving forward, but if you look at Tiger's career, he never played more than 20 or 21, or I shouldn't say never, rarely played more than 20, 21 events on the PGA Tour a year. There's a way of doing it to be smart, and I actually think less is more. And I think that Patrick has accidentally really stumbled upon a paradigm that is super healthy for everyone to follow moving forward. Play less, but really make those starts count. When you aren't playing in tournaments, rest your body, take care of your body in the weight, in the not weight room. By weight room, I don't mean lifting prodigious amounts of weights, but doing flexibility work, working small muscles, doing the smart kind of work that's going to prolong your career.
She is one of the best. New York Times sports writer Karen Krause. And up next, we look back to the Open Championship, specifically the week before the Open Championship, as we took dead aim at Royal Portrush with the host of Caddy Codes on shopwithgolf.com, the one and only Oliver Horovitz, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Oliver Horovitz is a former caddy at St. Andrews and is the current host of Caddy Codes on ShopWithGolf.com. Earlier this summer, prior to the Open Championship, we had the chance to discuss an episode where he played Royal Portrush, site of the game's oldest championship this year. Let me just say, once again, how impressed I am that you have been able to monetize boondoggles in the world of golf. It is, Ollie, it is stunning to me. Every time I flip onto your show, I'm like, holy crap, and he got paid to do this.
Let me emphasize this. I still haven't figured out how they let me do it, but so far they continue to say, yeah, sure, get on the plane. So I'm always getting on the plane.
It's incredible. I keep waiting for you to throw some idea like, I tell you what, I want to play golf in every continent in the next 7 days. Can we do that? Oh, sure, we'll pay for it.
Yeah, don't think I'm not thinking about that exact idea. But this is a fun one. Have you been over there before?
No. We're going to get to all of this because, you know, if I'm talking Lynx Golf, yeah, I'm talking to you. Because you're the man. Ollie Horovitz is the greatest caddy of all time that ever was an American in St. Andrews. I'm sure that list is not very long. All right.
Definitely only Jewish caddy.
All right. So you caddied for more than a decade at the home of golf, St. Andrews. I mean, when people think Lynx Golf, that's the first thing that pops into their head. So I would think it takes a lot to impress you when it comes to Lynx Golf, having spent as much time there as you did. That being said, first off, did Royal Portrush have a reputation over in the United Kingdom?
Well, yeah, sure. It's funny because every time I was thinking of going to Ireland or Northern Ireland, I was like, wait, there's so many courses I want to play in Scotland. Let me just go play there. So I hadn't been to Northern Ireland until this trip over.
Oh, wow.
I get over there and I'm like, oh, man, I really have been missing out. My first time seeing Royal Portrush was that trip a couple weeks ago. But we'd heard about it, sure. Yeah, we'd heard lots of things. We actually have a lot of caddies on the old course in St. Andrews who come from really close to Portrush in Donegal, just, half hour away from there.
Royal Portrush was described to me earlier in the show by Rex Hoggard of the Golf Channel as Lynx Golf meets Pebble Beach. And I thought that was an interesting assessment. You've seen both. What do you think?
Well, that's pretty good, actually. You walk the White Rocks Beach, which is the beach that's right by the golf course. It's very similar to West Sands in St. Andrews. And you look up, and you don't realize it's about 100-foot or 150-foot rise of the dune up to the fifth green in the golf course. And when you're playing out on five and you look out over the beach, is it Pebble? Yeah, it looks very close. It's one of the prettiest spots in golf I've ever been to. And the fact that you're just out on this point, you're looking out over the White Rocks, you're looking out over the, on a clear day, you're looking out to Scotland, literally. It's fantastic. Everyone needs to come over and play this golf course.
Ollie Horovitz is the host of Caddy Codes. It's on ShopWithGolf.com. It's a fantastic web series. You must check it out. This episode is dealing with Royal Portrush. You spent some time with a couple of caddies. We'll get to them in a second. I heard something, and this is geographically speaking, but it kind of made a lot of sense. Look, you spent time at St. Andrews. The weather in Scotland can get nasty. The wind, the rain, it can get nasty.
Yeah.
Someone told me, but at least Scotland has Ireland and Northern Ireland to buffet it. And there's nothing to buffet Northern Ireland from something we like to call the Atlantic Ocean. There's no landmass to get in the way of whatever's rolling in. From what you've heard or even what you may have seen, is there a possibility that weather there could be nastier than things we've seen in Scotland?
Oh, totally. I mean, so many of the greens are completely just shelterless. It's right off the coast onto these greens. They're buffeted by the wind. And when we were shooting there, it looks nice and sunny in the video, but we had to stop about every 20 minutes because just a rainstorm came in. So you go into these, there are these shelters in some of the hills that are set up on the golf course. It's sort of like being in The Hobbit. And we had to go into these shelters, I would say every 15 minutes, and just wait out this lashing rainstorm and then go back out. So it's like entire weather systems are being blown past you. That's how strong the wind is over there. And here's a little point that I hadn't really thought of much before this. It's another similarity to the old course. They're not going to have the greens probably faster than 10.5 on the stimp meter.
Because you can't.
They're just not. Yeah, it'll go unplayable. So there's a lot of slope on some. You know, the greens are relatively flat, but there is slope to them. And when that wind picks up, if you had them at 11.5 or 12, ain't happening. They're going unplayable.
I am just tickled pink at the notion of Al-Qaeda-like caves in the dunes of a golf course where you go and hide out while the weather comes in. Ollie Horvitz from Caddy Codes, shopwithgolf.com, is our guest taking Dead Aim. What are the differences that I keep hearing about Royal Port Rush? And I don't know if it's going to come through on TV. You know, it's sort of like until you go to Augusta National, you have no idea how hilly and up and down Augusta National is. Television does not do it justice. A lot of the links golf that we're used to seeing, the normal rota of the Open Championship, it's as flat as East Texas for the most part. That is not the case with Royal Port Rush.
It's not. There's a couple holes where you have tremendous swales in front of the green. The fifth hole, which we just talked about, has this crazy bump right in front of the green. Reminds me of the fourth hole on the old course with the hump in front of that one. There's a tremendous amount of undulation to the course, and there's a couple drivable holes out there. And look, the new holes they put in, 7 and 8, are fantastic holes. One of the ones, the seventh hole, par 5, I think it's playing 590 or something from the backs uphill into the wind. We played that hole for the Caddy Codes video, and it's like it looks like these holes have been there for hundreds of years. That's how good Martin Ebert's redesign was that he did. And it's also playing, by the way, it's playing 7,317 yards for the championship. So it ain't easy, especially if the wind blows.
Ollie, I realize the reasons why they probably didn't go to Ireland and Northern Ireland for close to 7 decades because of the civil unrest and the violence. Yeah. I get all of that. But you just brought up something that's interesting. Royal Port Rush is a big boy golf course. It's 7,300 yards.
Yeah.
Look, if there's no weather that comes in at St. Andrews, these guys brutalize and dehumanize St. Andrews.
Yeah.
There's so many courses that are like that. Look, I watched them take apart Carnoustie last year, and I'm sitting there going, this is Carfrickin'-Noustie.
Right.
You don't do this to Carnoustie.
What's happening?
Yeah, and they were treating it like a pitch and putt,
right.
Especially, you know, you remember the 18th hole with Vandeveld, and, you know, they're hitting, you know, these guys were hitting.
For their second shot.
Yeah, these guys were hitting driver pitching wedge.
I didn't love that, believe me.
I'm like, what are we talking about here? So is there a fear, I don't know if that may be a strong word, but with the RNA moving the Open Championship to a venue like Royal Port Rush, which has the 7,300 yards, do you see them starting to branch out a little bit out of their normal comfort zone and out of their rota out of necessity because of equipment?
Oh, that's interesting. I think that might have had a part to do with it. You know, it might have injected some kind of freshness to the rota, which is super nice. But I think a big part of it is your sort of flag bearers, Rory and Graham and Darren Clark, just, you know, continually reminding everyone, hey, we got great courses here. And I think sort of that buildup got louder and louder over the last decade. And, of course, you had the peace agreement in 98 that sort of settled things down in the region. We're talking about the Troubles. And, now that things have settled, it was like, why not? Why not go back to Port Rush? Obviously, hosting the Irish Open in, I think, 2012, that helped. That was just sold-out attendance. It was fantastic. People loved it. It's been at Port Stewart, I believe, as well, the Irish Open. So it was sort of like we got to get back here. So it's 68 years after it was last held in 1951, which is pretty unbelievable. And, oh, my God, are we in for just a treat on TV, because the course is going to look as nice as I think we've ever seen an Open Championship course look.
Ollie Horvitz is the host of Caddy Codes on shopwithgolf.com. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Great episode up there right now about Royal Port Rush. I promise we'll get back to the episode. The town of St. Andrews is a very small place. The little town And the golf course is in the center of town, and the town sort of wraps in and around the golf course at St. Andrews. This is a similar situation at Royal Portrush. One thing that I can already feel with coverage so far this week coming through the TV is the palpable energy and excitement from this small town.
Yes.
Maybe it's that way at St. Andrews, but we're just used to it. But there just seems to be just this great celebratory, overjoyed vibe
there. Great point. St. Andrews gets the Open every 5 years. Golf's been played there for 600 years. People are used to it. People are used to tourists coming in and the world spotlight being focused on the town. Portrush, a lot of people don't remember ever having the Open here in 51. And the entire week that I was in Portrush, everybody is talking about it. My hilarious B&B owners, this mother-daughter combo, were just like wide-eyed, like, oh, you're here because of the Open? Oh, cool. We're so pumped. The entire town is just like a smile on their face every day since it's been announced many years ago. And the members are pumped. I mean, look, the members are making a little sacrifice. Their golf course is getting taken away from them for a little while, but they couldn't care less. They're so psyched that the course is going to host the Open. Again, I spent a week, and I was walking around the town, and it's like St. Andrews in many ways. That beach, East Strand Beach, that wraps around Portrush, it reminds you of the West Sands Beach in St. Andrews, where they had the opening scene of Chariots of Fire. It's like a St. Andrews, but with 25 arcades. Everywhere you walk around in Portrush, there's another arcade or a amusement park. I'm not kidding you.
What's it like? You experience this living in St. Andrews, but also it's there in Portrush, too. When you have these courses in these small towns whose, you know, their economic paradigm is wrapped around the game of golf. Golf is a part of a culture over there, similar to the way in the southeastern United States they grow up with football. I grew up in Texas. Football is part of the culture. It's
right.
Ingrained in us. All of us are football people. What's it like to live in a place where golf is all-consuming?
Heaven. It's absolute heaven. I mean, look, Graham McDowell's brother is a greenkeeper at Portrush. They got a Scottish course manager, Graham Beat, who decided to come over and set up shop in Portrush. You've got people that have just grown up in Portrush that live there forever. The caddies are all from Northern Ireland. You've got people that are in love with golf, in love with the place that golf has taken up even throughout the Troubles. I think golf was an oasis for the people of Northern Ireland. It was a way to escape all the stuff going out in the course. That's what golf is for all of us, even in America. It's an escape from the scary stuff of real life. And this course is a gem. It's just a gem. So for everyone to know that it's coming back at you and it's going to be on TV and the world is focused, I said to everyone at the club, I said, just wait, because it's not even the attention this week. You're just going to see it next year when everybody wants to come over and play it. And by the way, when you're over there, you got a couple courses right nearby. You got Royal County Down, which is en route up to Portrush. You got to play there. You got Port Stewart, which is 10 minutes away. And you got Castle Rock, which is 10 minutes the other direction. So everybody who's thinking of doing a trip to Ireland, come up to Northern Ireland, too, and you've got some of the best golf you're going to play on the whole trip.
All right, let's talk about the episode, Caddy Codes. It's on shopwithgolf.com. Ollie Horovitz is our guest taking dead aim. Is it hard to caddy for a professional caddy? In other words, you kind of got the experience that we all have as far as, you know, look, these guys watch you practice. They get an idea about what kind of player you are before you step on the first tee. Yet all of us, I mean, you know, I get the feeling every time I'm at Pinehurst, and these guys know me at Pinehurst, but every time I want to stripe it off that first tee just to let them know I know what I'm doing, even though they know I know what I'm doing. When they're dealing with a caddy like you, is it hard for you? Is it hard for them?
Yeah, I think hard for me because I know how good they are. And I'm like, why am I caddying for Gaz Stevenson on the most famous hole at Portrush? And his father was the head pro at Royal Portrush, and his grandfather was the head pro before that for 55 years and actually played in the Open when it was there in 51. So Gaz, who's the nicest guy in the world, so is Eamon Hughes, the other caddy who is in the video. But Gaz and Eamon, they've been around it thousands of times. I just thought it would be cool to caddy for them because I'm like, look, you guys have caddied, you know, two rounds a day for the last, whatever, 6 months. Let me give you guys a break and you play a little bit. And Gaz is good. Gaz is a whole lot better than I am anyway. So wanted to have some good swings on the video for a change.
Yeah, they I think one of them, just you asked him, how many times have you caddied this course? Is it in the four digits?
Yeah.
And I think he said, you know, twice a day for 10 years, do the math, whatever that is.
I think 100 times, twice a day, times 10 years. I'm like, all right, that's four digits right there.
That's insane.
And you know what's funny is that, you know, because I caddied for 11 years on the old course, I guarantee you that we have overlaps. We have caddied for the same guys. Once at the old course and once at Port Rush. So I really felt a kindred, you know, I felt like a kindred spirit with these guys. There's so many links to St. Andrews, and it's the same kind of golf. It's along the ground. A lot of this course, the Dunluce Links, because there's two courses at Port Rush, Dunluce Links and the Valley Links, which is a smaller course. But there's so many similarities. It's played along the ground. You're putting whenever you can. If you come up short on both courses, the Dunluce and the old course, you're often in trouble. Long is usually better than short. So many elevated greens in the Dunluce. But it's also just, as you said before, it's like the fixation on golf with the whole town. So I really felt like I was back in St. Andrews. Plus, you can see Scotland from the golf course on a clear day. Literally, you can see 25 miles over to Scotland. How cool is that?
Better pubs where you were or Scotland?
Way better in St. Andrews. Come on. Come on. But if you're stuck with the pubs in Port Rush, you got to go to the Harbor Bar. That is the main one. Darren Clark has a booth in the Harbor Bar. It's got a hilarious bartender named Willie who definitely should be in movies. The fact that he's not a Hollywood star at this point is just a travesty, and he will take good care of you in the Harbor Bar, and the whole town is there. When I was there last time, I ran into Brooks Koepka's caddy, Ricky Elliott, and I got to hang out with him and just said how thrilled I was at all the success they're having. He's the nicest guy as well. You know, it's a trend. I just think everyone in Northern Ireland is incredibly nice.
Ollie Horovitz, Caddy Codes, Royal Port Rush is the latest episode. You can find it at shopwithgolf.com. Get you out of here. On this, and I'm not going to give away too much of the video because I want everyone to watch it because it really is spectacularly done. But for those of us that have never had the opportunity to go over and play Lynx Golf, there is an approach into the par five that you mentioned that really summed it up for me. And I was sitting there going, oh my God, I can't imagine a caddy telling me this. I think the yardage was 150 or 155.
Yep.
There was a 10 or 15 mile an hour wind.
Uphill.
And he looked at you, he said, and then add three clubs.
Yep. And it's one thing to tell someone that, which I've done before. It's another thing to hit a 5-iron from 150 when that's like a little 8-iron for me normally.
Yes, that's what I was thinking. Is the hardest part of that shot is the commitment because your eyes are telling you, this is an 8-iron, Jack. I don't know what this guy's smoking, but there's no way this is more than an 8-iron. And you hit that 5-iron on the screws, and it was perfect.
And it was pin high. It was pin high on the right. I just said, Eamon, you're the man. I'm just listening to you forever. But then on we did a little intro, and we hit. I hit a drive on the 16th hole, which is a par 3 calamity corner. I don't know if you noticed, it's only a 202-yard hole from where I teed off. I hit driver into the wind uphill. So welcome to Port Rush. That's what they're facing this week.
You must check out Caddy Codes on shopwithgolf.com. That's the great Oliver Horovitz. And when we return, in anticipation of next week's season kickoff of the Greenbrier, we take dead aim at a conversation we had a year ago with ECU Pirate Blake Taylor on his participation in last year's tournament, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Next week, the PGA Tour's 2019-2020 wraparound season begins with the military tribute at the Greenbrier. Last year, ECU Pirate Blake Taylor qualified for and played in this tournament, and we had the chance to speak about his experience. All right, Blake, look, you're a consistent starter last year for the Pirates, scoring average just over 72, low round a 65. First off, following the season, I'm sure you had in mind, you know, most of what you wanted to do golf-wise over the summer. How much of your off time is spent just playing and practicing versus tournaments to keep your competitive edge sharp? So, in other words, when you're plotting out your summer, what's your balance there?
In summer, I love playing. I know practice is necessary, and that's one place in my game that I have to work at is not to forget to practice too much. But I love playing, and so in the summer, I normally try to load up with as many tournaments as possible. So I stay busy. I'm obviously still practicing several times a week, but it feels like I'm playing at least every other week, if not even more than that, in some tournament somewhere.
Now, when you were thinking about your schedule heading into the summer, did you have on there try to qualify for the Greenbrier, or was this just something that came up?
I was looking at it. I thought about it last year and didn't for some reason. We plans fell through or whatever, and so this year I was like, you know what, I actually want to do it. I want to go try it. And so we had planned it kind of at the beginning of the year or at the beginning of the summer, and we're like, all right, we're going to set this little weekend aside and go up there and try it.
Now, where was the qualifier held?
It was in Daniels, West Virginia, about an hour from the Greenbrier at Glade Springs Resort.
Oh, okay. Glade Springs. Now, had you played that track before?
I had not. I got up there Thursday before the pre-qualifier and walked the course and played some holes, but that was the first time I'd seen it.
So sort of tell people the process here, because you just used a term pre-qualifier that I don't think people are aware of. So explain the whole process of qualifying to play in a PGA tournament.
For me and a lot of mini pros, but any amateur that doesn't have any kind of status, you have to go through a pre-qualifier, which is held on Friday before the Monday qualifier, and they take top 30 or 40 or so. And the score ended up being 71 is what got in to the qualifier, which is where you get into the field with the PGA guys and other guys that are trying to qualify for the Greenbrier.
Now, how many people were in the pre-qual?
It was a lot. It was over 100. They had tee times starting at 7:30 and going till I was the last tee time, and I think 3:10.
Well, at least you didn't have to sweat it. Once you walked off the course, you knew what you were doing, right?
Exactly. We knew there was no get in and then stress out for 4 hours. It was once I was in on the pre-qualifier, I knew I was good to go.
Blake Taylor is a golfer at East Carolina, qualified and played in the Greenbrier last week. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. All right, so you're in the qualifier on Monday. When did you tee off then, and how long did you have to sweat that out?
I teed off at 8:30.
Oh, God.
Yeah, they did double tee on Monday. On Friday, everybody went off one, and they double teed us on Monday. So I was 8:30 off 10 and had to wait a little bit, but the last time was about 10:30, I want to think, so it wasn't nearly as bad.
Oh, okay. I was just thinking all of a sudden you're getting done 4 hours before the last group comes in.
It was about 2 hours, so it was definitely stressful time, but I was trying to take my mind off of it, but it wasn't. I was stressing the whole wait.
Okay, so the pre-qualifier, more than 100 golfers. How many golfers were actually in the Monday qual?
It was probably around 70 or 80, if I had to guess.
And what was the score that you shot that got you in?
66. Got in par 71, so it was 5 under 66. And that got in a four-way playoff for 3 spots.
Which was more nerve-wracking? Waiting for everyone to get finished and see how you did, or walking out and participating in that four-man playoff?
Honestly, waiting. Waiting was definitely, I think, worse, because as far as playoffs go, that was one of the easier ones for me. I don't know why, but I guess being 4 for 3, you know, only one guy had to mess up and you were guaranteed to get in. So the waiting was stressful because I was thinking, okay, if anyone else comes in, you know, the spots keep chipping away. But luckily, after I came in,
there was already four other guys with 66 and one guy with 65. So I knew there was going to be a playoff as soon as I came in. And luckily no one after me shot that score or lower.
Blake Taylor, ECU golfer, qualified for the Greenbrier last week. He's our guest taking dead aim. All right, so you head out for the 4-for-3 playoff. How many holes did that go?
I was out on the first one. We had two pars. Me and one other guy made par, and then one guy made bogey, was in trouble off the tee, and then the third guy hit it on the green and three-putted. So luckily I didn't have to stress too long in the playoff.
Okay, so you go back with your family. All of a sudden, the let's make a weekend out of this becomes we're going to make a week out of this. What's it like scrambling for accommodations and everything else for that week?
It was pretty stressful because we knew it was busy, obviously, as busy as White Sulphur Springs gets. Probably their busiest week of the year. But the first night, we luckily found a place about 15 minutes out. And then the problem was the Monday qualifiers, they didn't have their names at the resort. So we couldn't just walk up Monday afternoon and say, hey, I'm playing, because they didn't have our names yet.
I'm just picturing all of a sudden, man, this is so great. Where the hell are we going to sleep tonight?
that was pretty much it. We were thinking for a little bit, like, all right, are we going to be sleeping in the car?
I was thinking this is a car sleeping situation. All right, so now you know you're in the field at a PGA Tour event. And, you know, look, you're a D1 golfer. And so that tells me you've won your fair share of events. And for the vast majority of your life, when you walk on a range, you feel more than you belong. You feel like you own the place. This has got to be a whole different vibe, though. What's it like that first time that you step on the range at the Greenbrier and you're inside the ropes and they're scrambling to get you the really good range balls that these guys play with, and you take your place on the range with the best golfers in the world? What is that feeling like for you?
It was a lot different, especially Tuesday when we got out there, and I just wanted to get out and practice a little bit before we went for a practice round. And being on the range was probably the biggest difference that I noticed, just because there's ropes and stuff everywhere. I played several amateur tournaments before where they have ropes around the tees and around the greens to keep spectators off, but not on the range. There's never anything on the range, and now there's a huge leaderboard and huge tents and trailers everywhere. And so that was definitely a different feel. And then just to look down, walking down the range, see all the names that are, you know, hidden right next to me, it was definitely a wild feeling.
What are you nervous about that first shot on the range? Because I have a feeling that I would have a fear of being Ten Cup McAvoy and starting to hit, you know, just huge hosel rockets down and I nail Lee Jansen or somebody. I mean, you know, that would be my greatest fear. Was there any fear when you took that first shot, or were you like, oh, okay?
Yeah, a little bit, but as far as that goes, I was confident enough to just know, you know, just focus on what you normally do and just hit it like normal and you'll be fine.
And that's the difference between people who know what they're doing and people like me. Blake Taylor's an ECU golfer, qualified for the Greenbrier, our guest taking dead aim. So you went out and played a practice round. I know Harold Varner's an ECU guy. Were you able to make contact with him, or who did you play with?
Yeah, I texted him on and off. I texted him right after I qualified and asked if he was playing, and he said he was, so I was pretty excited. But our schedules throughout the week were pretty off. He was playing – he played in the Pro-Am on Wednesday, and they closed the course to people that weren't playing in the Pro-Am, which I wasn't. So I had to get my practice round in Tuesday. He was taking it light because he was playing Wednesday. So we didn't play with him, but we did text back and forth a few times about the course and stuff like that. But I actually did get to play with Jim Furyk on Tuesday, which was
what a thrill!
Was a really fun experience. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
How did I know Jim treated you great, but how were the other pros towards you? Were they excited for you? Or did you feel like you were welcomed out there?
Yeah, definitely. the guys I played with, I mean, they were – everybody I played with was great guys. They all asked me about how school was going, you know, how y'all want to do this for a living and, you know, family, all that kind of stuff. So it was – it definitely made me feel welcome. It was a lot of fun, and I really enjoyed it.
Okay, well, let's get to round one. Who were your playing partners with for the first two rounds?
Omar Uresti and Rob Oppenheim.
Is Omar still a teaching pro?
I believe so, yeah. I know he does a lot of playing, but I'm pretty sure he is.
Yeah, because all of a sudden he'll pop up in the PGA, but under the you know, teaching professionals division now, even though I remember him from when he was on tour. So that's interesting. He was out there. And I remember checking my phone at the beach. I was following your progress. And, dude, you were scary for a while. You were like 3 under through your first 8 or 9 holes. Were you pinching yourself?
Yeah, kind of. I was going out, starting out thinking, you know, just make a lot of pars. And that was my focus, was just make pars and try to make as few bogeys as possible. And I was hitting it okay, but I was starting on the easier side. But putts were going in. That was the biggest thing. I mean, none of my birdie putts I made were really close, especially the one on 17 was about a 40-some footer. And when that went in, I was kind of like, whoa, you know, what are you doing?
Now, learning to keep your focus when you go low or you're going low is one thing. And it's one thing if you're at a college tournament or if you're at an amateur event. It's another when you're on the pro tour and all of a sudden you look up and you're like, wow, that standard says I'm 3 under. How hard was it for you to keep focused on each individual shot at that point?
It was difficult, but that's one good thing. I've been in situations like that in other big tournaments, so I tried to just treat it like that and tried to treat it like it was just another tournament. But it is hard, you know, saying it's just another tournament when it's,
yeah,
you're playing with the guys you're playing with, and there's crowds starting to form and stuff like that. So,
did you use a local caddy, or was your dad on the bag? Or
my dad was on the bag.
How thrilled was he? I mean, he you probably still can't erase the smile off his face, right?
Yeah, he had a lot of fun, and he actually when I got through the first round of qualifying, he came up for the Monday qualifier and caddied for me in that, and so we kind of got adjusted, I guess. Got adjusted to the new distances and stuff because the elevation
right.
All goes a little further.
Now,
he had a lot of fun, and we had a lot of fun together.
That's awesome. Now, the second 9 didn't go as well as the first. What were you thinking when you walked off the course? Was it disappointment? Was it, were you encouraged? Were you just, or was it such excitement of what you were doing that you didn't care? You just didn't want to leave the course.
Yeah, it was disappointment at first because, I knew I was 3 under and I knew there's no reason I shouldn't have shot under par that first day, at least 1 or 2 under. But, you know, then my dad was like, hey, look, I mean, that's still a good round. You're still not out of it. Good round tomorrow, and we're still playing the weekend. So it quickly went to, you know, okay, yeah, I'm just glad I'm here again. But it was definitely a little disappointment at first.
Yeah, and then you didn't make the cut, so ended on Friday. But how do you feel heading into next fall with this behind you now?
It's a big confidence builder because I putted really well this past week, but I didn't hit it well at all, not nearly as good as I normally do. And I know that if I did hit it like normal, then I feel like I would have made the cut pretty easily. I would have been 3, 4, 5 under. So I'm taking that away from it.
What's left for you for the rest of the summer? Are you going to try to qualify for anything else in a pro world, or are you looking at some major amateur events? What are you doing?
I've got the Carolinas Am this weekend in Pinehurst at Country Club in North Carolina. And And then I leave straight from that on Sunday and go to Kentucky for the Southern Am.
Going to try to qualify for the USAM? I know there's a bunch of USAM qualifiers coming up in the next 3 or 4 weeks.
Yep, that's I have that right when I get back from the Southern. I think I have one or two days off, and then I play in my USAM qualifier up in at Scotch Hall.
Well, cool, man. Well, best of luck to you the rest of the summer and heading into your fall season. I know Coach Sapp was just blown away with excitement about what you were doing. So best of luck to you, okay?
Thank you. I appreciate it.
He's gone on to be the number one player on ECU's roster. From a year ago, that's Blake Taylor. I hope you also enjoyed revisiting our conversations with Oliver Horovitz from Caddy Codes on ShopWithGolf.com and New York Times sports writer, the brilliant Karen Krause. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, BPod Studios, Spotify, all the usual podcast outlets, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there now, links to articles on the latest goings-on in and around the game. Hey, weather-wise, man, you can't beat this weekend for teeing it up and letting this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golf guy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.